Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The recent enthusiasm over extracting natural gas from shale has been compared to the gold rush of the 1800s. But it's not just a question of finding it. It's a question of extracting it. At what cost and to whom? Joining me to talk about some of the market and environmental questions related to the rush for natural gas, Ian Urbina. He's a reporter for the New York Times. Seamus McGraw. He's a writer and author of a book titled The End of Country. From a studio at Cornell University, Tony Ingraffia. He's a professor of engineering. And by phone from Harrisburg, John Hanger. He's former secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. And I would very much like to note, we were hoping that the associations representing the natural gas industry, such as America's Natural Gas Alliance, would be on this program. They were invited, but they declined. And, of course, I'll invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ian, morning. If I could start with you, in your lead stories that ran Sunday and yesterday in the New York Times, you write about concerns that companies have been overstating the amount of gas they can economically produce in a given year. Talk about that concern and why it should be of concern to everyone.
So the stories looked at what seems to be a bit of a disconnect between the rhetoric surrounding, the public rhetoric surrounding natural gas, and the more private discussion occurring within the industry and among some federal regulators about natural gas. There's a lot of excitement about natural gas for environmental reasons, because it's abundant, and there's indeed nothing we saw contests how much gas there is under the ground. But what was striking was that we had a collection of emails, many of them from within the oil and gas industry, and then in yesterday's story, many others from within the Energy Information Administration, which is the federal oversight administration, in which you have industry and regulators talking about whether the gas can be affordably pulled out of the ground, and whether there may be a bit of an overstatement occurring about that process, and how to get a more candid discussion of that. And so I think it's relevant to the rest of us, because, number one, there's a broad embrace of natural gas occurring in the country, and it seems that a full and candid discussion of all the factors that play into the long-term viability of this energy source, including the business factors, is key. What companies can do it best? Are they big? Are they small? How much can they make? Is it a lot or is it a little? What does the sale price of gas need to be for companies to do well? How will investors, lenders, landowners profit in actual terms or not if they get behind the industry?
And Ian, what about varying factors across the country? Are there cost differentials in Texas, say, from those in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale?
There are. It's a good question. There's a lot of variability shale play to shale play, so shale formation to shale formation. So what the Barnett looks like, with the Barnett Shale is a shale formation in Texas, and it's one of the earliest ones to be drilled. The economics of the Barnett Shale are different, and so is the geology, than the economics of the Marcellus Shale. Lots of factors come into play, from the type of rock to the distance of transport. Marcellus has the big advantage of being very close to market, and so that shale formation, the producers have to transport the gas smaller distances to get to consumers, and that means their cost structure is better. And the other point I'll add is Marcellus drilling started much later than Barnett drilling did, and therefore technology is more advanced and sophistication of how to get the gas out of the ground is further along.
Ian Urbina, he's a reporter for the New York Times. Seamus McGraw, this Marcellus Shale is an area of the country you know very well. You've written about it in your book, The End of Country. In fact, your mother was one of the first to receive a leasing offer. Tell us what happened.
Well, it kind of came out of the blue. My mother's a widow living alone on what had been the farm that had been sort of the touchstone for the whole family. And as I say in the book, the first time I heard about this, I couldn't have told you the difference between Marcellus Shale and Cassius Clay. I'd never heard of it, never heard anything about it. And she was approached by a young woman with a nose ring who was going from farm to farm up there offering leases. Nobody really had any idea what was going on. My mother picked up the phone to me and to my sister and said, "See what you can find out." And we started to kind of explore it, started to kind of look around. In the end, we ultimately made the decision that we made for a number of reasons. But it was not an easy decision. This is, as I've said, Dan, it is a development that offers a great deal of promise, that throws a lifeline to a lot of people. Including a lot of the farmers. You know, when I was a kid, you could drive the 4 miles from Route 6 to our farm and see 18 farms. There are two left now. And those farms were disappearing, and they were disappearing to a very great extent because of energy costs. That was one of the things that was driving the farms under. And now a lifeline to some degree has been thrown, but not without a cost. There is real risk associated with this. The question really comes down to managing that risk. Can we do it? And more importantly, do we have the character to do it? And that's what I really try to explore in my book.
Seamus McGraw, he's writer and author of a book titled The End of Country. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Tony Ingrappia, you have been studying this shale fracking, as it were, for quite some time. Tell us about what you see as the benefits and the risks.
The potential benefits include the increase in the natural gas supply available onshore to the U.S., potential benefits to individual landowners and businessmen associated with all of the contracting necessary to extract the natural gas. The potential downsides, I should say real downsides also, since they're occurring in all the shale gas explorations and developments going on, include risk to the environment and to human health and loss of property values. To extract gas from a shale formation is a substantially different process with much more risk associated with it than what is called conventional gas and oil development, which has been happening in many of the same areas for many decades. And each of those risks, as Seamus just pointed out, would best be quantified before proceeding. And that quantification, unfortunately, is now going on in real time by experiment rather than by study, scientific study and technological developments that should have preceded the development as it's happening in many cases at full scale.
And what kinds of risks are you talking about?
There are three levels that I refer to in risk. One is the one that unfortunately is associated with the moniker given to this development, which is called fracking. And that's a risk that occurs many thousands of feet underground and is relatively low probability. And that's the risk of the gas, the fracking chemicals, and other materials that have been safely stored in that shale for hundreds of millions of years, finding their way upwards into groundwater. So that's a relatively low risk to human health and the environment. The next higher risk is what happens during the drilling process on the way down to that formation. And there you have problems of well failure, either by casing or cement failure, which could lead to migration of methane or other materials, again, into groundwater. And the highest risk of all is everything that happens on the surface. This is a highly intense industrial practice, which needs to be happening over a relatively large area because the shale is over that area and you have to develop all of it in order to meet the aforementioned ideas of getting nearly 25 years of supply of natural gas just out of the Marcellus alone.
Tony Ingrappia, he's professor of engineering at Cornell University. When we come back after a short break, we'll hear from John Hanger, former Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection. And welcome back. We're talking about gas extraction, which is happening all over the country. The process known as fracking, which has certainly led to a number of individual landowners receiving money for leasing of their property to the gas companies. It's resulted in some profit to those landowners. We're talking about both the economic and the environmental aspects of fracking. And let's now bring in John Hanger, former Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. John, you heard Tony Ingrappia talking about the three risks that he sees as most prominent. To what extent did the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection take into account the possibility of those kinds of problems before entering into agreements with these companies?
Well, the first thing is that Pennsylvania doesn't enter into agreements with the companies other than on the state forest, where we have leased some state forest land, though there is now a moratorium on further leasing for gas drilling of the state forests. Pennsylvania did a number of things when I became secretary of the department. It's just September of 2008. We moved four regulatory packages, one strengthening the rules on water withdrawal, one strengthening the rules on water disposal. I'm glad to say today that there's less drilling wastewater going into our rivers and streams than before the first Marcellus well was drilled in Pennsylvania. Third thing we did, we put in place a 150-foot buffer requirement from all development, not just drilling, for our high-quality streams, which is a quarter of all of our streams. And the fourth thing we did is we greatly strengthened our drilling standards for casing, cementing, and the process of actually doing a gas well. I also want to say, Diane, that shale gas now provides 25% of all of the gas in the United States. I heat at home with gas. I buy wind power for my electricity, but I heat at home with gas, as 51% of the people in the United States do. Consumers have saved about $1,000 in lower gas bills and lower electric bills because we make a lot of electricity from gas as a result of this extraordinary new actual real production. It's not a Ponzi scheme. It's not Enron. It's real production that has changed the economics of gas. It has lowered the gas price from $13 a thousand cubic feet in 2008 to now around $4 a thousand cubic feet. So that shale gas has saved consumers a lot of money, and it has actually caused old coal-fired power plants that are literally, according to EPA, killing each year 17,000 families to increasingly be retired by their owners because gas is available and it's low cost.
John, I'd be interested in knowing how many different hydrofracking sites there are in Pennsylvania.
Well, again, hydrofracking has been going on around the country for decades.
No, in Pennsylvania,
in terms of the
Marcellus
site,
asking
how many are
right.
the shale sites.
Yeah.
We now have over 3,000 gas wells, Marcellus gas wells drilled in
And can you tell me, number one, how these sites are monitored, how many investigators you have monitoring these sites?
Right. And in fact, that's the next thing Pennsylvania did, and probably actually the only state to do it. We more than doubled the oil and gas staff. I ordered, with Governor Rendell's blessing, hiring in 2009 and 2010. We went from 88 people who full-time worked on oil and gas with other people working part-time to 202 people working full-time on oil and gas, more than doubled the staffing. And that's a very important thing. The inspections need to occur, and then the inspectors need to be told to enforce the law. And in 2010, Pennsylvania wrote 1,200 violations to this industry. Nearly all of those violations were not appealed by the industry, which is a good thing. They corrected the violations. They responded to the violations in an appropriate manner. So enforcement and staffing is critical to making sure that this industry is strongly regulated.
All right. And coming back to you, Tony Ingraffia, do you see this kind of monitoring as sufficient for the amount of fracking that's going on around the country?
No, I don't. You can double the staff, but you need to know what staff you need. You can double a small number and still have an insufficient staff. And just speaking of the Marcellus, for example, in Pennsylvania, but we're talking about shale gas development not only around the country but also around the world. And we are talking about a situation where a typical well might in its lifetime produce millions of dollars worth of natural gas. And Secretary Hanger himself has been quoted as saying that the fines that are imposed for regulations, violation of regulations, are much too low. When a company can produce millions of dollars from one well but commit a very serious environmental regulation infraction and be fined only a few thousand dollars, there's hardly an incentive to keep up with regulations, especially when you have a very large number of operators, over 70 in Pennsylvania, some of whom do not have the technical staff or the financial backing to pay the extra amount of money necessary to keep up with regulations.
What about that, Ian Urbina? Did Were you looking at the kind of monitoring that's going on in these hydrofracking sites around the country?
We looked at Pennsylvania and a very specific issue in Pennsylvania with regard to monitoring. We were interested in general to look places that people, that we thought the there wasn't enough attention. And there had long been discussion and knowledge that there was a certain amount of radioactivity, naturally occurring radioactivity, coming up in the wastewater of these wells. But there was not a handle on how much, what levels, what type, and what was done with that wastewater after it left the well. And so that's specifically what we looked at. And to make a long story short, what we found was that there wasn't sufficient oversight of that component and tracking of that water, which was at that time being run through facilities that were unable to, for the most part, of removing the radioactivity before the remains were discharged into rivers. And so the piece essentially concluded that there needed to be more oversight and ongoing testing if that water was going to be handled in that way.
You finally concluded that you would lease your mother's property. You tell a story about the amount of money paid.
Mm-hmm. In the situation, what had happened was the landman, a very straightforward guy, a guy who looked at me at one point and, you know, concerns about just pouring money into places where there hasn't been any for a long time. And actually, at one point said to me, "I'm killing this country." And what he meant wasn't the risks of the environmental risks themselves. What he was talking about was the idea of the stress that that kind of money coming into a community that hasn't had it in a very long time can create. But what had happened was we had settled on an offer. We had put a number of environmental protections.
How many acres?
It's 100 acres in northern Wyoming County. Literally, the back of our property is the Susquehanna County line in northeastern Pennsylvania. And what is, at least according to Ian's story on Sunday, those are the most productive areas of the Marcellus and dry. We had settled on $2,000 an acre. And the landman came in to my mother's dining room. She made him a cup of coffee with the china cups that she puts out for special occasions. He said, "I've got all your addenda, but I've got an addition. It's $2,500 an acre." Without lifting a finger, my mother had made twice the per capita mean income for the county that she lived in, doing nothing. And to this day, we can't figure out exactly why, except that it may have had something to do with Chesapeake was the company we signed with, trying to ascertain their position, make their position dominant in the play, and do it by slathering money.
Now, complaints about the kind of leasing that has been done?
Have I heard complaints about
it? No. Have you had complaints?
No. Have I had complaints? Do I complain? No. Let me put it this way. You know somebody's trying to sell you something, and my family, the people that we know and live with, they're not fools. They know somebody was trying to sell them something, but they also knew that what was trying to be sold had a real value. Tony earlier in the conversation mentioned that there were four risks that he identified from the Marcellus. There's a fourth, I think, that we don't talk about as much, and that is doing nothing. Doing absolutely nothing. We have a serious energy problem in this country. Everything in this country, in one way or another, dovetails with energy. And doing nothing is not an option.
Tony Ingraffia, Ian Urbina talked earlier about the kinds of infractions that the fracking companies are committing and the kind of oversight that perhaps is not being applied is the Marcellus Shale, because apparently they're using more advanced techniques. Is the Marcellus Shale at lower risk than some of the other sites across the country?
No, I would say that any shale gas development creates higher risk than previous so-called conventional developments, which many states have seen for many, many decades, simply because the volumes of fracking fluid necessary are 10 to 100 times higher than those previously needed. And second, that the intensity of the industrial development, because these wells are so large, brings with it attendant additional risk. And third, the wells need to be everywhere. The shale gas development is such that the gas is everywhere in the shale, not uniformly distributed. Some wells are much better than others, as we're finding out. But because the gas is everywhere, the ideal thing for the industry to do is to drill everywhere. So that means that the risks are going to go up because you have a larger number of wells, of larger wells, with larger volumes of material that needs to be created, injected, recovered, stored, transported, and ultimately, hopefully, safely disposed of. All those things increase risk compared to what we've had in the past.
Tony Ingraffia, he is professor of engineering at Cornell University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Jared. You're on the air.
Hi. I work as a mud engineer, and I kind of disagree with how the fracking works as far as it not having an effect, because what he just mentioned is that, you know, they have to do more and more wells. So now it's a big habit to do these super pads where the wells are only on at surface about 8 feet apart, and then down at the bottom they're a couple thousand feet apart. But we've seen on completely normal occurrence where they'll frack a well simultaneously next to us while we're drilling a well, and we'll start losing all of our mud or our drilling fluid. And it happens over and over. And usually everyone on site will agree that it can happen, but the offices typically don't agree with that. And I guess the whole point of my conversation is to say I think there's a lot of variables that happen that no one really can explain, because I usually think of the fracking as if you get a chip on your windshield, and those cracks can go any way, any length, and you just don't really know. It's completely unpredictable.
Ian, can you speak to that?
Well, I think the sentiment conveyed is one that I hear over and over again from guys like this who are on the front lines, and petroleum geologists who you know, are willing to talk with anonymity because they could get fired otherwise. And that is that there's a lot of sophistication in this type of drilling, and there have been amazing advancements in the technology. And Seamus is quite right that, you know, we have to discuss this in the realm of limited options. We have to do something. But at the same time, there needs to be a more candid discussion of the unpredictability of this type of drilling, like the gentleman was saying. What occurs below ground, where these fractures go, how far they reach, what impact they can have, and also just from a regulatory perspective, the best practices of an industry about how wells are designed is one thing. Whether there are the resources to enforce those best practices and the manpower is another.
John Hanger, can you speak to that unpredictability?
Certainly. But first, I have to point out that Pennsylvania has, in fact, tested all of its waters in response to the New York Times story. And not surprisingly, there is no radiation contamination in Pennsylvania's waters. It's all at background levels. So the
what does at background levels mean?
Means that when you walk outside, you're going to encounter some radiation.
Yes.
There's a natural occurring amount. There's no such thing as a zero radiation environment.
at least not naturally. But all of the waters in Pennsylvania have been tested by the Department of Environmental Protection, by the drinking water companies, both in-stream testing and drinking water testing at the tap, and all the water has no radiation in it. It meets the Safe Drinking Water Act. I wish the New York Times would put that on the front page.
All right, do you want to respond, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, those tests are great news. And that was ultimately the point of the first round of stories, was to compel the state to begin testing. I think the key, though, is ongoing testing.
Excuse me, John, hold on.
I think as long as water is being handled the way it was, there needs to be continual testing. Water levels vary in rivers. And it needs to be an ongoing process.
He's a reporter for the New York Times. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning historian argues the American Revolution is still the most important event in our country's history. Why he credits the era with defining America's values and aspirations. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And let's go right back to the phones to Flower Mound, Texas. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Diane. Hi. I live in Flower Mound, Texas. It's an affluent suburb outside of Dallas, population about 80,000 people, and average house sells for around $300,000 to $500,000. House farms, I mean, horse farms, it's just beautiful. The oil company came in, told us, you know, how small an impact the drilling would have, and that they would take care of it, keep it all, you know, very low impact. But what has happened is, excuse me, I'm very uptight, but they've just done the opposite. The truck traffic, which goes 24 hours a day, is a huge pollution. There's all kinds of pipes and drilling and mud, you know, leaking out into these pools that then fill up with rainwater and go into our drinking water. They've had a high impact. And all the laws in Texas are from the 40s and from out basically in West Texas, where the population is zero, and they don't really have it. It's not keeping up with what's going on in the reality of the drilling.
Tony and Graf here.
What?
Tony.
Yes.
Are you there?
I am. I was just listening to what Jim had to say.
Okay, can you respond?
Yes. What Jim did is amplified on what I said before about the surface impacts and the risks of surface impact. To put a gas development of this type using high-volume slickwater hydraulic fracturing multi-well pads inside a residential area is lunacy, and Jim is experiencing that as well as lots of other people in and around Dallas. And people are beginning to experience it around Pennsylvania, which is at the very early part. Let's remember, Dallas, the Barnett has 13,000 wells over the last 15 years. Pennsylvania has 3,000 wells over the last 4 years, but is slated to see something like 100,000 wells or more. So the kinds of incidents and impact that Jim just described is inevitable when we go to areas with larger density of population.
But, Tony, on the other hand, as Seamus has talked about, these individuals have entered into these agreements voluntarily. They've received generous amounts of money. Shouldn't that be enough?
It might be enough for those who have, but not everyone has. We have situations in some states, for example, in my state, New York, called compulsory integration, where it could be that the vast majority of the people living in an area that has been targeted for gas development by one company don't have the option of saying no. So their neighbors are gaining wealth at the risk of the health of other neighbors. And that's something that we have to come to grips with.
What do you think about that, Ian? I know that you'll be talking as time goes on to some of those who have leased their property. But what about this New York law of compulsory integration?
I don't know a lot about it, so I'm going to duck that question. I haven't researched it closely. I can say something about well density. I think that's a really important issue, and it relates to leases. And I think it's especially important from an economic perspective as well, on the heels of these recent stories. If over the long run these wells produce, and when I say long run, I mean decades, these wells produce a lot less gas than was initially predicted, then they're going to need to be refracked, and or new additional wells will have to be dropped in place. And that means more wells. And again, the discussion about what that looks like 10, 20, 30 years down the road and whether regulations have been written to plan for that is something that needs to occur now.
John Hanger, is Pennsylvania likely to adopt similar compulsory integration laws?
Probably not here. I think, rightly or wrongly, that issue has been made radioactive. That's the only thing that's radioactive in Pennsylvania is probably that pooling law. And again, there's upsides to that law. Good things about having such a law, and there are some downsides. Those who value property rights above everything are opposed to it. Those who are actually interested in spacing out and limiting the surface impacts ought to be for such a rule. And for such a law, because it can, in fact, make sure the development at the surface is much less dense than it otherwise may otherwise be.
John Hanger, you spoke earlier about radiation. There are other concerns beyond radiation. Are there not the kinds of other chemicals going into the fracking?
Yes, let's talk about that.
Sure, companies have not voluntarily disclosed. Isn't that correct?
Some have voluntarily disclosed. Most have not. The Pennsylvania law now actually requires disclosure. I ordered that the information be put up on the website as early as 2008 that we had, and now the law actually requires it, effective as of February of 2011. There are risks associated with drilling. It needs to be strongly regulated and, in my view, fairly taxed, reasonably taxed. Pennsylvania right now does not have a drilling tax. It should have a drilling tax. But it also is the case, and I was the chair of the Pennsylvania Coal Mine Safety Board, that if we say no to gas, as I think Mr. Engraffio wants us to do, or shale gas, which is 25% of the nation's natural gas supply. We are saying yes to more coal and more oil, both of which are many times worse for the environment, and in the case of oil, it comes disproportionately from overseas.
On the other hand, there are alternative sources of energy, for example, wind and solar.
There are alternative sources of energy, and I'm a huge proponent of wind and solar. Pennsylvania has 16 operating wind farms, 4 under construction. We rank second in the nation in solar jobs, with over 6,000 solar facilities operating today or under construction. I personally have put a great deal of my professional life into promoting renewable energy. It provides roughly about 11% of our total energy right now renewable, including corn ethanol and large hydro, which a lot of environmentalists have problems with. We will be doing very well by 2020, a decade from now, if renewable energy is providing 20% of our total energy. That means 80% is going to come from coal, oil, gas, or nuclear. I live in the Three Mile Island evacuation area. Now, all of these sources of energy have risks associated with them, but when I look at it, it's clear in terms of both the economic benefits, the national security, and the public health benefits, natural gas is a better choice than coal and oil,
right,
and one can argue about nuclear.
All right. Here's an email from Julia, who says, I understand that in West Virginia, the gas companies and gas investors own the rights to the gas under the ground. The rights to the gas may be under your property, in which case they can come in and begin fracking on your property without your permission or paying you. What do your guests say about this? Tony and Graffia, have you seen this?
Yes, but I would like to respond, since Secretary Hanger mentioned my name explicitly and misrepresented my position. So I need to clarify.
All right.
The choice of what to do from a national strategic energy perspective is different than the choice of what to do from a corporate business plan perspective. So he is correct in saying that natural gas has to play a role over the next generation in our national energy strategy. But it is incorrect to say without constraint. And that constraint is the biggest question of all, which we haven't discussed yet, and that is global climate change. As Secretary Hanger knows full well, and I'm sure he agrees, that is the single most environmental and human health risk facing the world today. And unfortunately, natural gas is a fossil fuel. And unfortunately, it is not a perfectly clean fossil fuel. The result of burning natural gas produces carbon dioxide. But the process of getting it out of the ground, processing it, transporting it, and storing it releases methane. And as he well knows, the industry needs to clean up its act with respect to purposeful and accidental venting of methane during those processes. And until they do so, large-scale development of shale gas is a risk, an unacceptable risk, to global climate change.
All right. Here's an email from Catherine in Bethesda, Maryland. She says, please tell me about activities in the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, specifically with respect to monitoring the environmental impacts of oil and gas extraction. We've received an offer to lease our mineral rights there. We've been trying to research the environmental issues. However, we've been taken aback by what appears to be almost an absence of watchdog activities by both government and non-government entities. For example, we gather the EPA no longer monitors air quality in Williston, North Dakota, which is almost in the middle of the Bakken. Tony, can you comment?
Well, I can comment on the problem of the everyday citizen, whether he or she wants to lease or not, being able to get valid, accurate, scientific-based information concerning the development, whether it's in the Bakken or the Barnett or the Marcellus. That's a problem. And it's a problem that our legislators, our universities, and the gas and oil industry itself have responsibility to fix. So advertisements on TV, which require millions of dollars of investment on the part of the gas industry, is not a good way to inform the public. A good way to inform the public is by providing the public with valid, scientifically based information. And unfortunately, when such information becomes available, the immediate knee-jerk response on the part of the industry is to say it's wrong. In other words, it's okay to do science as long as the answer is what they want.
Shameless.
I think the issue is that there's no question that there needs to be substantial oversight. But I wanted to go back to something that Tony had mentioned before, and it really comes down to this. We do have there is a much larger than necessary carbon footprint to shale gas drilling. It strikes me as being terribly ironic that this fuel that we keep touting as being a cleaner burning alternative to coal and a safer alternative in terms of politics to oil is not widely used. In fact, in the Marcellus, hardly used at all to develop the shale gas. It seems to me that if the industry, and I know they've talked about it, wanted to turn around and make that point better than the ads on television, they could do it by shifting the focus to that and using the natural gas to get the natural gas and using that to make their point.
Seamus McGraw, he is writer and author of The End of Country, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Delphi Falls, New York. Good morning, Velda. Let's see. Velda, are you there? Sorry, this phone is... Can you open line 5, please? All right, I'm sorry. That's not working right now. What's the future of fracking as you have done your research in? Is it going to expand? Is it going to have greater regulation? Is it going to have less regulation and big profits for everyone?
It's a tough question to predict the future. If I had to guess, I would say I think fracking will continue and expand. It's a vital technology that the majority of the industry uses, and it's everywhere. I think that regulation, whether it will increase, is a debate being decided in the next 2 years. You know, right now, the EPA is doing this national study. There's a lot of activity on the Hill with people of different leanings. Some argue that this should be left to the states. Others argue that the federal government should take a bigger role. And that debate is ongoing. I think that whether it's regulated more will probably be decided by whether the federal regulators get more involved. On the state level, I think there'll be ebbs and flows depending on the administration in office in terms of regulation. But on the federal level, I think there'll be new laws in the next couple of years.
John Hanger, do you think that the regulation belongs to the states or to the federal government? John Hanger, do we have you? Sorry. We've lost him. Tony Ingraffia, where do you see it going?
As far as regulations are concerned, there are three elements to that. One, you have to have the correct regulations. Two, they should be uniformly applied. And three, they have to be strictly enforced. So you can have regulations that are enforced and are uniform, i.e. federal regulations, but if they're not right, not the right ones, there's no good being done. So we're still in the process of developing the correct regulations because, as I said before, this process of high-volume slick water hydraulic fracturing in shale is a process in evolution. Uniformity requires that across states we have the same correct regulations because I live 50 miles from Pennsylvania. If New York has very strict and correct regulations and Pennsylvania does not, I'm downstream. I have my health in jeopardy. So Whether we have a federal set of regulations or a uniform set of state regulations is irrelevant to me as long as they're uniform and as long as all of the technology, everything, is correctly addressed and there are proper and very stiff penalties for violations.
Tony Ingraffia, he's professor of engineering at Cornell University. Ian Urbina, reporter for The New York Times. Seamus McGraw, he's author of The End of Country. And John Hanger, former secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.